begin there. So this week we're on to the Gothic. The Gothic is essentially being, well, the lecture's called the Gothic, but we're covering everything from the end of the Roman Empire, the Dark Ages, and the kind of mix of styles that come out during the Dark Ages. And then the re-emergence into medieval times, where some kind of order returns to a Europe that's kind of fallen to bits. And then into the High Gothic, which chronologically overlaps with what we talk about next week with the Renaissance. However, it's very much a distinctive, separate style. So when we go to the Renaissance, we're kind of returning to an art history that comes out of the Mediterranean, the classical tradition, things like that, you know, Italy and the Mediterranean in general, Greece, things like this. With the Gothic, we're talking about a Northern European phenomenon that comes out of the Grunewald or the Greenwood, which was essentially during the times of the Roman Empire onwards, the whole of Northern Europe was covered in one gigantic wood, and the Romans considered it the end of the world, in the same way that when they got to North Africa and they reached a desert, and they essentially thought, well, that's desert as far as the eye can see, so that's the end of the world. They got to Germany and they saw woods as far as the eye could see and assumed, okay, we've reached the end of the world here. The Roman Empire spans the whole world. And so it's largely a German style, but we see it appearing in Scandinavia, in some of it in the Dutch areas, northern France and in Britain, but it's mostly Germanic as a style. But that discussion of the Gothic will come at the end. We're going to start with a kind of overview of where we left off last week and talk about some of the common factors of the kind of medieval times and the particular kind of new view of the world that emerges from them, a Christian view of the world, or informed and structured by a new religion, essentially. So we've got a good opening image here of a saint. You can see she's a saint, she's got the halo, dragging out a very strange looking dragon, sort of a half dog, half reptile, half lion, and dragging this dragon, which represents all the sins and evil of the world, out of its cave, in the lairs, beneath the world, into the daylight, where these two gentlemen, our good Christian warriors, are stabbing it and shooting it and killing it dead. I thought it was a good image to open with, firstly because it's a bit strange looking. It's like she's leading along this dragon on a rein as if it's like, you know, kind of taking a dog for a walk. And it's violent and it's got a good dragon in it, so it's a bit strange. All the stuff that you expect from medieval times. But it's a good one to indicate, I suppose, the specific and particular worldview which we're looking at that underlines the whole way of being within the medieval period, which is that essentially it's a Christian worldview, but when we say Christian today, we tend to think about sort of Christian media, Christian moral messages, which tend to focus on the good, on being good, on good things. But when we're talking about it in this term, we're talking about a worldview that encapsulates both the good that you're supposed to be and the bad that is constantly threatening to destroy you, the world of sin and suffering and pain and sorrow. When we think back to the Egyptians, that's a kind of timeless image of the whole world that they present. When we see the classical, it's kind of individual heroes going out and conquering this dark world. Whereas when we look at art from the Middle Ages, we're seeing a world that is itself conceived as dangerous and deadly and sinful. That the material bodies that we inhabit are sources of sin, that they're constantly being threatened by nature, threatened by the dark things around us and surrounding us. And the only image of a perfect world that really exists is one that is outside of this world. Which makes sense when you consider how vicious and violent these times were. Everyone was constantly fighting, sick from plagues, lots of death and suffering and struggle. And so the world of the kingdom of heaven, whether that's the kingdom of heaven that you look up to and pray to, that's kind of above us in a transcendental state, or whether it's something that you visit after you're dead, or whether it's at the end of the world itself, which, you know, a lot of Christian art at this time is predicting the apocalypse, when finally this world will be destroyed and the new better world will emerge. It's an image that sees that there is a perfect world, but it's just not the one that we're in. And that our struggle in the world is to try and reach that transcendental one. Whereas the one that we're in is constantly sort of dragging us down into the sort of depths like this cave. It's a threat like this terrifying kind of lizard monster that'll eat us. That our own bodies are a threat, that the world itself and nature are kind of all in on this grand conspiracy led by the devil to kind of bring us down into the world and destroy our immortal souls. And so this duality, this dualism, is what we're going to find all the way through this narrative. But to begin, we'll cut back and we'll look at a little bit of late period Roman art. So this is the Berberini ivory from Constantinople, 540 AD. As we can see, it's not quite up to the standards of some of the Roman art we've seen in the previous lecture. And this is because this is art that has been produced after the Roman Empire has fallen in the West. So everything from Greece westwards is no longer part of the Roman Empire. It's simply warring factions, hundreds of small war bands fighting it out over the wreckage and the ruin of an entirely destroyed civilization. All knowledge, all technology has gone. And in the East, we have people just living out this constant fantasy of Rome, with all of the kind of innovativeness and the core messages of it hollowed out. And so we see that we've got some decent, you know, attempts at the human figure, but they're slightly rounder, they're slightly more kind of an artist's impression rather than a realistic depiction. And we got a lot of Christian messages in it. So this will kind of indicate to us some of the things that are occurring within the aftermath of Rome. Because last week we talked about the way that Rome and its sort of ideology, the way it saw itself, its civilization hollowed out from within. But, you know, to follow Spengler's line of argument, a civilization can be hollowed out for quite a long time before it collapses. When it collapses, it tends to need, it needs like a prod to push it over the edge. And in Rome, that prod took two forms. There was external force that brought it to its knees, which was, as we mentioned last week, the hordes of barbarians that kind of flooded into Europe and destroyed it militarily. These were people who had no idea about any of the benefits of civilization because they kind of lived hand to mouth off the land, and so they had living, more vital, vicious, violent kind of religions and ways of seeing the world. And when they met with the kind of Romans who were, you know, civilized and sophisticated but seemed to be weak and effeminate and had no way of defending themselves, they simply saw people who were worth killing in order to steal their stuff. So there's that external sort of terrifying force from outside, but internally there was also a religious revolution going on. So the religion of ancient Rome, that was that polytheistic view of the gods, that the gods are these kind of heroic figures who are neither good nor evil, you just have to stay out of the way and hope that they don't hurt you because they're just powerful. And it was that religion that made sense in the classical world. But it stopped making sense when the Roman Empire reached its boundaries. And essentially that heroic ability to go out and adventure stopped being an actual reality for people, even though that's what their gods were like and what their hero stories were like. And so this new religion that comes out of the Middle East, Christianity, emerges and very rapidly takes over the Roman Empire. With Constantine, it becomes the official religion of Rome, and it takes a little while for it to get processed and to kind of properly form into place, because the new Christian idea of God is radically different from the gods of ancient Rome. The gods of ancient Rome are just very, very powerful beings. They don't have any moral codes. Whereas the Christian God, he's the God of the Jews, which means that he follows laws. He is the living embodiment of law and justice. And the Christian element that's added to that is the idea that God loves you individually and that he's inviting you to join his kingdom in heaven, either on this world or the next, depending on the interpretations. There's all sorts of wars fought over the interpretations of these minor points. But ultimately, it's the idea that there is a perfect classical style ordered world. It's just not this one, it's the next one. And you can imagine that in the kind of hollowed out former glory of Rome, this was a very appealing idea that, you know, we can kind of see that at one point Rome did make sense, but now we can pretend that there's going to be a new and better one at the end of the world. And so this kind of two forces that pull Rome apart, the Christianity within it and the pagan hordes without, can be seen in the Dark Ages, in the way that Dark Ages are, is essentially a kind of a continuation but also a replacement of classical art. So classical art, with the fall of the Roman Empire, there's no more architects. Architecture as a practice disappears, as does engineering, using mathematics and things. At the end of the Roman Empire, that disappears, doesn't come back till the Renaissance. In its place, you've got sort of individual craftsmen. So on the right-hand side here, we have a bit of what we would call Romanesque mosaic sort of artwork. And on the left, we have some pagan. In this particular instance, it's Viking, even though Viking is a little bit later in the Dark Ages, 900 AD. This is the Ernest Stave Church. It's a bit of Viking art. I think Viking art is the most developed of all of the Dark Ages art forms. Celtic art gets really developed, but usually after it's become Christianized. Viking art is a perfect example of the kind of power that you can get from this raw pagan art form. You can see that unlike the classical, it's full of just like turning, you know, it's very natural forms, but they're kind of aggressive nature. It's nature in its most slithering, writhing, fertile, fecund form, where endless forms of tentacles and snakes and sort of branches are all creeping around each other. It's the kind of art that you would expect someone who lives in a dark forest, who's surrounded always by sort of hunting, killing, fishing, blood, sacrifices, things like that. You've got here a kind of deer that's turning into a monster that's being strangled by various different tendrils. It's the art of a kind of dark world view. And indeed, the Vikings had one of the, you know, goriest of religions, which was essentially, unless you died in battle, you went to hell. And if you did die in battle, you got to go to heaven. But heaven was a feasting hall where you prepared for the final fight, in which you will inevitably lose to the gods that will destroy you. So, if you die in battle, that's the only way you'll get to heaven, and heaven is just essentially waiting to lose the battle again. So these kind of pagan arts, which are very visceral and very alive, they were moving through all of Northern Europe as the Romans and the classical sort of moved away. And then the Romanesque, which we see on the right, was essentially a kind of church art style. It was an art style for people who wished that they could produce things that they could see in the church. They could still see the remnants of what the Romans did, but they had really no idea on an intellectual level how they were done. And so you can see it is a mosaic, which is copying, you know, what they've seen the Romans do, but the detail is far less refined. All that nice posing work, the contrapposto, is gone. The lighting is totally flat. You've got some pretty bad anatomy in the legs. It's looking very stilted. And they've attempted to replicate gold by using yellow and earth tones, because they kind of know that they were supposed to use gold, because the Roman stuff might have had some gold in it, but instead it's a kind of just yellowy kind of saturated pattern. And the faces are all a little bit generic looking, because they've lost that capacity to replicate individual physiognomy. And so you have these two forces, which is essentially the remnant, the sort of dying memories of the classical, with this new and vital pagan force. If we look a bit more at some pagan art, we can see in this Viking stuff that it's largely driven by the necessity of the thing. There is no kind of the necessity of objects. So we've got weaponry. The artist carved here into the weapon to imbue it with magical powers, which is a return to that ancient way of thinking, like give a weapon power by carving runes into it. We have a terrifying sort of wooden head of a longship that would be there to kind of terrify their enemies and to guide them up, by showing this kind of demonic carved figure that will come out of come out of the night and terrify people, breathing fumes. And then even on their churches, which this is from, you can see these wooden carvings are showing a man about to be torn to bits or in battle with a giant dragon. Lots of interweaving into sort of mingling chaotic strands, lots of darkness and things. Here's another piece where we've got a big monster scowling out with these boogy eyes. He's kind of a warrior, but he's also kind of screaming. Dragons, lizards, this kind of puma thing looking out with big insect eyes. It's a world of kind of terror, but that's all, alive and writhing. Interestingly, most of this stuff is made of wood as well. So this is also why Viking art tends to have survived better, because Viking art is up in where there's lots of snow, and snow dries the atmosphere. So there's churches that are up in Norway and Sweden that where you've got wooden carvings that are 1,000 years old, which is impossible to imagine in Britain. If you make something out of wood in Britain and leave it outside, give it 10 years, it'll have washed away with all the rain and things like that, or just, you know, rotted away. So presumably there was equally kind of ornate pagan art across all of Northern Europe and all of the Grunewald, the Greenwood. It's interesting that it's made of wood, because it suggests, well, firstly it fits with their environment because they're surrounded by the woods, but it also suggests that they're not thinking of immortality. They're not thinking of making things that will last. The classical, the Egyptian, they made things out of stone, they made things out of metal, they made things out of, you know, brass. They built things that would last. And they also made art for art's sake. All of this stuff is functional. It's there because it's on a church door, it's there because it's on a weapon, it's there because it's on a longbow or a shield. They're simply making things for the now. They don't have this concept of making something that will last for eternity, which we saw earlier. If we look at other styles that emerge, we've got Anglo-Saxon art, like this mask here, where we can see lots of knots and tangles, the kind of lots and lots of detail, which is sort of showing off this image of the world as a chaotic place, but the knots kind of tie it together. It's a suggestion of all the energies of the world being united. Tying knots in things was a defense against magic, which takes us back to primitive art again. When you were going to do magic, you had to take all of the knots out of your hair and out of your clothes so that the magic could flow through you. If you wanted to be defended against magic, you would tie lots of knots in your hair. And then Celtic art is fascinating because, again, it shows a world that's full of kind of swirling, chaotic patterns, rhythmical miasmas. You've got loads of circles, loads of knots, wheels within wheels, hundreds of tiny little bits of detail all competing with each other in this kind of endless dance of madness. Later on it gets balanced out, and lots of kind of pre-existing ideas, like they had lots of things in threes suggesting the three forms of matter and stuff, which then get adopted into Christian art, so they become, you know, about the Trinity and things like this. So Celtic art lives on a lot longer than other Dark Ages art in its own unique forms. In terms of the Romanesque, we've got a couple of churches here. So this one is in San Salvador, and we have in Spain, and we have a basilica from France next. So you can see with the Romanesque how it's nowhere near as impressive, it's nowhere near as alive as pagan art, because pagan art is part of that culture. It's exactly right for its time and place. There are small war bands, all of them fighting desperately to survive. It's a place of loads of bloodshed and fighting. Sometimes there's between 6 and 18 different supposed kings fighting over England at this time, just to give you a sense of how chaotic things were. Meanwhile, in the churches, this an attempt to retain some kind of identity that's trans-tribal, that's kind of sticks to this dying language of Latin. It's the only people who could read, the only people who could kind of speak other people's languages. They were all church people, and they attempted to keep building this style of architecture simply by having like the sons and grandsons of builders who'd worked for Roman architects replicating patterns over and over, less and less successfully. So here we've got the columns that are very Romanesque. You can see that they've made arches, they've made columns, but they're not very tall compared to what we've seen in the Roman era. And we've also got this roof that's slightly Romanesque. It's terracotta, but it's a kind of roof you'd have in a house. It's not a very kind of church-like roof. And then we have the added spire, which is more like a Norman bit of architecture. So they're integrating what they know of architecture, standard bits of things you'd have in houses or in kind of defensive structures, and kind of building in Roman elements in an attempt to keep Roman kind of ideas and the classical ideas going. Here's another example. This is the interior this time of a church in the Sainte Madeleine in Vézelay, France. You can see here the arches have moved inside as an attempt to keep... Well, it's really what they've tried to do is build a building that's got more than one level, because that was almost impossible in the Dark Ages to conceive of something that would have two stories. And they've managed it, but by kind of jerry-rigging these arches, like the round arches you see on exterior points on Roman buildings, and they've put them inside. And you can see they're not necessarily work. There's loads of unevenness. There's kind of the roof itself looks really, really unstable. And you have that with a lot of these buildings, is reports of them just falling down because they're kind of attempting to replicate something they've seen, but they have no idea structurally why these things work. They're just doing it because they've seen it before. And so it's kind of a miracle that this one still survives. But you can see that there's this attempt to build in a classical style. That very, very narrowness that becomes a standard of churches is also due to structural necessity, because they could not conceive of building a roof big enough to house that classical square structure. There's some great ones from Britain. So this is the Church of St. Lawrence in Bradford-upon-Avon, built in 709 AD. And you can see that it's essentially a British-style, just square stone, almost a farmhouse-looking thing. But they've got these Romanesque sort of pillars built in here. And we can tell that the pillars haven't really worked because they had to add stone to keep it from falling down. which is never a good sign. Well, we can see that they attempted at one point two builds in a Roman style and couldn't quite manage it. Here we've got the All Saints Church, Earls Barton from 1055. This one is kind of interesting because it uses the same Romanesque arches there, but also these pillars that are built into the wall this time in an attempt to keep the wall up whilst they've got a very tall tower. Up here they've kind of braced it to make sure it doesn't fall. All of these sort of what are supposed to be elegant arches are all lopsided, they're all wonky. And this that's in between the arches is wattle and daub, which is what they would have made their houses out of, where they weave together lots of twigs and then they cover it in manure and then they whitewash over it. Which had, as you can imagine, no structural integrity. On the normal houses, you could build them just about big enough to fit into, but any bigger, you couldn't put a second story on it, it'd all collapse. And they built that in here between the Roman arches as an attempt to build things higher. It's kind of worked. I mean, it's been around for 1,000 years, so it just doesn't look very elegant. And then this one's the Church of St. Mary at Sompting, which is even more fascinating because it's kind of filled in the areas between the structural pillars with just normal brickwork that you'd find in a house. And then at the top of the spire, they've attempted to build like a, using what they knew from normal houses, roofing structures, to build a really tall roof and attempt to make a spire. So yeah, we can see in all this that the Romanesque was a desperate attempt to find some order in this world, which eventually finds its way, I suppose, into the Christian art and architecture. But it slowly gives way to a kind of that pagan spirit. So even though paganism is replaced eventually by Christianity, the legacy of that art and the vitalness of that art remains in the imagination of the Christian people. So here's just a kind of classic medieval image where we can see some knights fighting with some evil things. This I think is a good summary image because it's captures the medieval attitude to nature, which is that nature is this vicious, violent thing where you've got, this is a horned deer with terrifying tusks that's leaping out, spitting at these good Christian knights who are all stabbing it in the throat and protecting themselves with this armor plating, a sort of silvery armor. We've got angry bats in the sky. We've got vicious rats that are eating the head of this knight down here. It's an image of the world where the world itself is corrupt and evil, and it's this living, sort of thrashing nature that we see in Viking art that is the hell of the Christians. It gives them all of the imagination that they need to understand hell and the dangers of this fallen world, and gives them a kind of guide to creating their art, whilst they themselves wrap themselves in armor, become these kind of embodiments of bringing order back through fighting. So yeah, in the medieval world we have three stations of people. Medieval world comes at the end of the long period of the Dark Ages, where eventually through endless warring we had the certain warlords took over significant enough areas to become kings. And a king would be put on earth by God, and he would appoint earls who would like own large amounts of land, and the earls would appoint knights who would be in every village, kind of. They would command everyone, but they would also be called upon to fight. And these were the first group that were called those who fight. So we've got those who fight, those who pray, and those who work. And those who fight are kind of this warrior class, the aristocracy, who create order. And then we have those who pray. So we can see here there's the knight. To the left of him is a priest or a monk. He's got the kind of monkish hairstyle, although priests had that at the time as well. And those who pray, yes, it was the religious people, but also at this time you have to factor in that the church and that kind of the remaining people who have any capacity for I don't know, abstract thinking are all in the church as well. So the church is doing religion, but it's also the civil service. It's also the only people who can read and write. It's also a kind of the records keepers. It's decides a lot of laws, essentially does the rule of law. The civil law is done by the church. And then the final class is those who work. So here we have a chappie with his spade looking on at the knight and the priest with a kind of admiring glance, which is kind of the role of working people. You don't see many working people in the art of the medieval times, largely because they were although they were about 90% of the population, they didn't have much say in anything. They had to do what the church told them or what the knight told them. They couldn't even leave their village without permission, and they only really got permission either to go to war or to go on a pilgrimage. On the left here, we have a bit of the Bayeux tapestry, and we can see the three stations in a kind of indicative way. So this is King William the Conqueror, about to take over England. To his left is a wise monk who's got his kind of monk haircut. And he's instructing and pointing him, telling him what to do. To his right, he's got his general, who represents those who fight. And he's, as you can see, about to bring out his sword to unleash some violence upon his enemies. And then around him and under him, we have these birds. And birds are the traditional symbol of those who work. So often they wouldn't depict working people, they were unlike normal people. They would just put them as birds. Which is, if you've ever seen St. Francis, that's kind of a suggestion of... St. Francis was famous for preaching to birds and for kind of telling sermons to birds. But it's likely that it's because the traditional depiction that he would have been, you know, giving sermons to poor people. And the traditional way of depicting poor people was as birds. So that's why you have birds all over the place here. Now, we'll go through each of these. Those who pray first, then those who fight, and then we'll end with those who work. So we'll begin with those who pray. I really love this image. I think it really summarizes everything in the medieval worldview and the medieval kind of religious and social worldview. In it, we have two monks. One of them is being carried off, dragged away by demons, and one down here is receiving from him with a kind of nervous look on his face, because there's an urgent look on the guy's face who's being dragged away by demons. And he's holding a Bible, which he's received, and here he's passing from hand to hand, from one to the other, is a whip or a flail. And the job of that is to whip yourself whenever you feel any temptation and to drive away the sin by punishing your own body. And by the look on this guy's eyes, it's very clear that you better make use of both of these two things, because if you don't make use of the Bible and of that sort of self-punishing whip, what is coming for you is, other than these demons up here, who all look kind of terrifying and scary and are dragging him away for punishment, you've got here hell itself. And hell is surrounded by a huge impenetrable wall that means you will never escape it. Underneath are the jaws of the devil. This is the devil's mouth, who's like a giant eagle crocodile creature with a funny nose, who's like half reptile, half predator. And he's munching and chewing up all of the sinners, all of the, you know, the kind of corrupt world itself. And in here, we have people that we would probably not expect to see. We've got kings, we've got bishops. Well, there's a king, there's a bishop, there's a monk. And we've got all the kind of people of this world, even those who present themselves as powerful, are being churned around in this chaotic mess and mash, where they're being tortured by terrifying demons who've got kind of the head of an elephant and the head of a rabbit. Corrupt creatures made of all the different body parts of the fallible animals of this world. And this is essentially telling us, this is what happens if you stay on this earth, is you'll meet an inevitable death and doom through hell. And so you can see on the communication of this guy's eyes, you better use the Bible, because that'll teach you how to stay good. And you better use this whip, because your own body is going to betray you into hell. The urgency of this image might seem very dramatic to us now, but if we take a look at something like Lindisfarne, which is a sort of fortress monastery up in the northeast, we can maybe understand a bit about why they thought this way and why this was the worldview that they had. So Lindisfarne is sort of an island. It's a tidal island, so twice a day, when the tide goes out, there's enough of a connection between the mainland and Lindisfarne Island for you to walk across. And then the rest of the time, it's an island, which is really useful for defensive purposes, because this place did get invaded twice by Vikings who killed everyone and stole everything in it. And in there, up in this big intimidating fortress on top of a rock, you had the monks. And these monks were at times the only Christians for hundreds of miles around. The nearest other Christians were down in Italy. And they were up there attempting to pass, like those monks that we saw, from hand to hand, the whip and the Bible, the kind of the self-punishing idea, and then the ideas, the sort of conceptual ideas written in the book. And they passed this down literally almost by keeping the books, rewriting the books whenever they would get frayed and torn. They would take old books and copy them out. And that was the only way that a lot of this knowledge got passed on, was by a handful of people up there. And they did a lot of praying, and they did a lot of kind of self-flagellation, making sure that they themselves remained pure, that they didn't give in to the dangerous world outside. They weren't driven to go outside. So things like the Latin language, things like the knowledge and science of the past, things like the Bible and the biblical knowledge and the kind of symbolism of the Bible remained in these areas, which also served as things like it was a waypoint for people on pilgrimages. If you stopped in there and you were poor, they would feed you. They had to grow their own food. They also had to, there was only records because they had no record keeping outside of the monasteries because it was just too chaotic. They would be destroyed. And there would be no one to understand the records either because they couldn't really read and write. And there wasn't much paper. They had to put it on the skin of animals because they weren't producing paper. And they also had other things like music that was, you know, produced in there and things like that. So it was a little kind of core of civilization and civilized values in the midst of this warring pagan sort of society. There's a really fascinating bit in the Book of Saint Bernard, which is the book that's like the guide to how to be a monk. It's kind of the monastic rule is it St. Bernard or St. Bertram? So I think it's St. Bernard. But in there, it's got all the stuff you'd expect in the laws for being a monk, which is like you've got to pray three times a day, you have to wake up in the middle of the night and pray, you've got to make sure that you don't sin, all the monks have to sleep in the same room so that no one can be sinning, because when you're out of the sight of the Lord, you start to sin. And it's all that stuff that you'd expect. But then in there, there's a little kind of line that really, for me, opened up the life of the medieval monk, which is that all monks should be expected to sleep with their knives underneath their pillows because of the danger, essentially, which was a real danger. You know, Vikings did come and kill them all. And so all the monks would sleep with their knives to hand so that if someone came in the night, they could, you know, have a bit of defense against these things. We don't normally think about medieval monks being fighters. They probably weren't very good fighters, but they had these knives around because it was such a dangerous area. But if we compare this kind of outcast up on a rock legacy of the Dark Ages, kind of the Dark Ages Christianity, which is kind of, you know, batten down the hatches, let's just keep the light of civilization, the torch passed from generation to generation, to the High Gothic, which we see here in, I can't believe I've forgotten the name of it, the cathedral in Paris, Notre Dame, there you go, obvious. So in Notre Dame Cathedral, we can see how this kind of tiny niche religion grew back out and flourished again until we have what's essentially a giant palace built for the sake of religion, because later on, as the medieval period sort of medieval, you know, kings made things secure enough, the church grew in power along with that stability to the point where we have giant cathedrals to those who pray, which were seen as being, whereas this world was corrupt and this world was filled with kind of vileness and it was something to be reviled, the cathedral didn't apply, these rules didn't apply to the cathedral, because the cathedral was seen as being the living embodiment of the kingdom of heaven on this earth, and so making it look as beautiful as possible was kind of a religious duty. That's why they put the gargoyles outside it, because the gargoyles are kind of ugliness to keep the ugliness away, and so the inside the church or the cathedral would be a sacred space where you can finally have a glimpse of what it might be like when the kingdom of heaven comes. And so we can see on this highly developed Gothic style, we have all of that really ornate filigree and kind of organic lines flowing together. This tower in particular is what they call in the decorated style, where it's got loads of little bits of ornamentation over it. In that is the legacy of these pagan artworks that are all kind of intermeshed and very vital looking. And we have out here the flying buttresses. Flying buttresses are fascinating because the buttress began as a kind of attempt to fix the problems that emerged when people couldn't make things as good as the Romans. So the buttress was just, they realized that walls kept falling down, pillars kept falling down. If you stuck an extra bit to the side of your wall, it would buttress it and stop it from falling down. And then generations of builders got better and better at building these buttresses until they started showing off by moving them away from the wall. So these flying buttresses are kind of buttresses that are built to show off that you can have these external buttresses. It helps the thing not fall over, but it's also kind of showing off how good they've gone without any architects or engineers really understanding. So they didn't know why it stood up, but they were good enough to know that it did. And these things were built over hundreds of years, so it would be generation upon generation passing this knowledge down. If we look inside the church, we can see that it's a very different space than we've seen so far in our history of art for a religious space. It's for gathering in a way that the Greeks were, but they have seats. So we sit and we look to the front, and at the front is our altar, and our altar is full of gold and sort of precious things to emphasize how precious they are. But we don't have much art on the walls. Instead, the art is largely concentrated higher up. And in the Gothic style in particular, we have no windows down at the bottom. So they're very, very dark places intentionally, because you put the windows up at the top here. And that means that you get this effect that, you know, in video games we call it God rays, don't we? Where you've got vertical or it's diagonal light sources coming down. And you have that idea that the light is coming from above and falling down onto us in the way that God's grace goes from the transcendental, which is up above in heaven, and falls down onto us here on the earth. And so we're down here in the darkness, in the metaphorical and literal darkness, and God's light comes down from above and kind of enlightens us as we're down here.
There's a cathedral I've been to in Germany which looks very similar inside, the same thing, where they've got the windows above.
Mm.
Except, I kid you not, every single inch of the place is covered in gold.
Really?
Yeah, it's basically like the floor is stone, like all walls, everything is covered in gold. And it's so weird because the only light is from the top, you can barely see where you're going. The sun will catch a bit of gold that just sort of glimmers, and it's really strange in there.
Right. It might be a Baroque thing, because the Baroque took a load of this stuff and then, yeah, did stuff like crazy things, like made the whole thing out of gold and stuff.
Yeah. I don't know where it is in Germany, because on the German exchange we went to a bunch of places.
Oh. Find out where it is and let me know, because I'd be interested to see it. So in these windows, in this glass that was high up in the tops of these cathedrals, we have the emergence of stained glass. So stained glass is the kind of quintessential Gothic art form. Stained glass is fascinating because not only has it got a really powerful artistic sort of potential to it, so glass was really, really rare back in these days. Like, to give you a sense of how rare, like the Tudors were a lot later than the medieval times, but even then, Little Moreton Hall, that's about an hour and a half away if you're driving, if you go there, then they have the windows they used to pop out, because they were an incredibly rich family, but windows were so rare that they would have their windows in at home, but then when they went to someone else's house, they would take all the windows out and they would carry it with them, and if they went abroad, they would bury them under the ground like treasure, because just having glass was such a rare sort of luxury. Whereas having stained glass was even more rare and expensive, but because of, you know, the power of the church at this time, they could afford it. And so you would have these stained glass images high above, and they would bring this coloured light down into the darkness, which would be visually really stimulating. You'd have never seen anything like that if you were a religious person at the time. But if you were a peasant who was just coming to the cathedral, it would be astounding to see it, sort of miraculous. But also they work on a kind of metaphorical level, in that the understanding of angels and saints, and even Jesus himself at these times, was that God is the Jewish God. He's inconceivable. You can't really put a face to him. If you attempt to see God's face, it will fry your brain. He's such a kind of powerful, unknowable figure. We as humans aren't capable of understanding God. And so what God does is shine his light through Jesus, and then also through the religious figures like saints and martyrs. And we can understand God through those kind of avatars that he adopts. And so that theological idea is embodied in the stained glass, where we have depictions of, like, we've got an angel here, we've got a saint, we've got a nun here, who's probably another kind of saint or sacred person. And the literal light from the sun comes through it and shines down and gives us the image. So it works on a metaphorical as well as on a literal level. There's also in these, this is an English cathedral, I forget which one, I should have written it down. This is the English Perpendicular style, which is a style which embraces the vertical as much as possible, these really tall Gothic styles. But in this super tall kind of cathedral style, we also see the remnants and the relics of, well, if we're talking in Spenglerian terms, of that original culture. If we think of those pagans who were out in the woods living in, you know, the deepest, darkest woods that stretch for as far as the eye can see in every direction. The only contact that they would have with anything transcendental other than the, you know, the world around them, which would be covered in these woods with these tall trees, would be to look up through the partings between the trees, or to go into sacred groves and sacred clearings and look up at the sky, where you would, you know, see blue coming through, light falling through the trees, or at night you would see it, have a glimpse of the kind of infinite sky with all of the stars and the planets and the moon all up there, kind of far up in the distance, too high to really see much of it, but you'd be glimpsing it through the trees. And that retains its kind of power over the imagination, the Northern European imagination, and moves its way into the cathedrals. So to return to my kind of pet theory that you can see a lot about a society from the way it uses its pillars, the Gothic brings pillars inside. So we had some inside pillars with the Egyptians, but largely they were to mark out the way of movement, the way of travel, and the pillars for the classical style are always on the outside holding up the roof. Here the pillars have moved inside and they have this verticality, these vertical stripes that look a lot like the super tall trees that you see in the Greenwood. When you actually get to see some of that ancient woodland, it's always really tall trees. There's a lot of it left in Poland, bits of it in Sherwood Forest, although it's mostly oak trees there now. And they reach up, and then at the top of them, particularly in the perpendicular style, you can see how these tree-like interior columns branch out like tree branches. And we have this complex filigree, the natural shapes. There's an order to them now. They're more symmetrical because they're done for the sake of, you know, order and religion. But that use of detail is replicating tree branches and the kind of living leaves and kind of intermeshing things, but here it's done to hold up the roof, so it has a practical function as well. You also find in some cathedrals, this is Ely, which is a fascinating cathedral in a tiny little town. My brother lives in Ely. They would do all their paintings on the roof. We see some of this in the Renaissance, but it tends to be, at least before the Sistine Chapel, you would have paintings on the walls and then you would do a painting on the roof to kind of accentuate them. But here you had no paintings on the walls, no decoration at all on the walls, because this is the world we're in, this is the fallen world, the world of darkness. And up there, through the tree trunks, is heaven, and in heaven is all of these holy angels and colours and magical things that we can look up and aspire to. And so that act of looking up is a kind of act of aiming for transcendence. The philosophy of images at the time as well tends to embrace this idea of using them for religious and spiritual purposes. So when we find images like these icons, the Christ on the cross, Mother Mary with her son, the idea was that you would use them, the word that they always use is contemplation, and it's separate and distinct from what people are doing in different eras. So later on we can appreciate artworks as self-contained things. We look at them like objects. And in the classical world that was the same. It's sometimes they'd have a kind of power to, you want to aspire to be these heroes, or, you know, they might be an erotic artwork if it's late period Rome. But the idea of these images was that they were to aid us to contemplation. So here on the right we have Jesus suffering on the cross. This develops into the 14, I think, stations of the cross, which you were supposed to travel and around each of the stations, which is like each step on Jesus's journey up the mountain and up to Calvary, nailed to the cross and to die. And you're both, it's kind of in a time when everyone is, can't read and has very little idea of what's in the Bible, and they wouldn't necessarily even teach it on the pulpit, they'd just give the core messages. It was a good way of teaching people. It had an educational function to follow each of these images. But the idea was you would get in front of each of them, say a prayer, and then imagine the sufferings of Christ. And you would look at the body in pain and tormented, and you would try and imagine that physical pain, because physical pain was a route to then what comes at the end, which is when he rises from the dead, as we were all kind of promised to be as well. And so by understanding his pain, we get a kind of redemption from it. The images of Mother Mary are more to do, I think, with the way that we're supposed to react to these images. So this one in particular has, you know, Mother Mary looking down at Christ. This is the same image in hundreds of forms, is replicated thousands of times, these icons. I tend to think of them like in modern movies where you have the reaction shot. So in a modern movie where you've got You know, it's a horror movie, someone gets stabbed. They always cut to someone seeing them getting stabbed and they're screaming. Ah! And you've got a big close-up of like a screaming face. And that's to kind of tell us that's what we're supposed to feel. Like, we're supposed to be scared because this person is scared. Or it's a sad scene, something sad happens. We cut to a close-up of someone crying and the tears are coming down their face. And we feel sad. I think it's a kind of evolutionary thing. We look at someone's face feeling something and we kind of take on that feeling. It's a kind of natural mimicry behavior. And so, for me, these kind of serve that function. We look at Mary looking on her son, and we see her pride and her kind of her love, her motherly love, and we can look at her motherly love and we can feel it because it's telling us what to feel for Jesus. We're supposed to feel as well the way that she does, kind of proud and loving towards him. And then the other famous image of the Mother Mary is holding her dead son in her arms. It's called the Pieta. And that one we're supposed to look at his suffering, but also look at the way that she's reacting. So she's heartbroken, her child is dead, and we are supposed to feel that feeling that she has. It's a kind of connection between we, the every person, our Mother Mary, responding to this otherworldly Christ in that way. So yeah, we'll move on to those who fight. We have some knights here doing duels. So those who fight began as just the warlords, but slowly became more kind of hierarchized until we had the feudal system, that idea of having kings who had lords who then had knights and vassals. And there was a structure to it that was structured hierarchically. They, interestingly, also in this Christian time become Christian warriors. There's a kind of religious function to these knights, and they act things out in ritual. So you have the kind of ritualized idea of the joust, the ritualized idea of kind of the knights of good practice that you would, you know, on the battlefield, that a good knight was not supposed to stab someone in the back. They were not supposed to hit someone when they were down. If they take over a city that has surrendered, you weren't supposed to harm anyone. The idea of the good knight, the knight who is a good Christian, the Christianity and fighting can be stuck together, was a particularly kind of Middle Ages notion. Like the original Christ died because he wouldn't fight. And here we have this renewed version of it, a repackaged ideal that the good person is someone who does fight. And they themselves are wrapped in this armor that's then wrapped in artworks, kind of flowing robes and colors, and a very sort of visualization of the armored person who is not of this world. He's not nature. He's not a kind of raw sinful body. Instead, he's covered in armor, so the devil can't get to him, and he's carrying gold and sort of symbols of religion and of his family. So if we look at the development of this armor, it interests, well, to something like this, which is full of signs and sigils and sort of important signifiers, it began from an essentially religious function, which was that sometime around the, well, very early, in fact, the 10th, 11th centuries, the Christian world decided it wanted to reconquer the Middle East, to take back the Holy Land from the Muslims. And so there was a series of crusades where lots of people got together and went out to fight the Muslims. When they arrived in the Middle East, they realized that wearing plate armor and wearing, you know, plate armor like this, wearing chainmail like this, covering yourself in metal, was not a very good idea when you're in the middle of a desert and it's boiling hot sun, and they all start getting heat stroke and collapsing and dehydrating, and essentially were being killed by their own armor. So they realized if you put a cloak over the armor, that'll protect you because the sun will get absorbed by the material. And so they created surcoats, which are these things. And so this is a very basic surcoat. It's just white with a bit of black. And they were originally there just as a functional thing. So they were just a kind of white sackcloth covering to protect your armor from the sun and to keep you from kind of passing out. Very quickly, they realized they could make religious markings on it. So you had the cross of St. George, which was the symbol of Richard the Lionheart, which was a red cross painted on the white background. You had the Knights Templar, who put a black cross on themselves. And this got taken back from the Holy Land to Europe, where it developed, and the people realized, well, we can use these surcoats and then we can adorn them with extra things. We can paint stuff on them. We can create a whole language of symbols that explains us as knights. So in sort of later in the medieval period, we have knights like this. This chap's covered in sort of crosses made from fishes, which is rather fascinating. The fish being a symbol of Christ. He was being a fisher of men. And here we have a knight who's covered in moons and stars, which have both feudal significance, because you would carry your family's symbols on you, but you would also carry religious symbols, and it would be part of this patterning would give a language so that you could recognize each other on the battlefield, which also fits with this idea of knights being gentlemanly, because you weren't attempting to just kind of massacre anonymous people. It was man to man, two knights who are both chivalrous will fight each other to see who's the best, but they won't cheat, they won't do anything that's not fair play. And intriguingly, this kind of ritualized behavior sort of served a leveling function as well in terms of society. So you had people who could work their way up from being a very poor knight in an area without much in the way of farming or anything. People like William Marshall, for example, he worked his way up through doing jousts and performing these kind of, during the kind of ritual carnival celebrations, to the point where he was so respected by the king that he was made a general, and then he went out and he won a ton of battles on the battlefield, and then he got made an earl, and it ended up that William Marshall, who came from essentially a poor background, through doing this kind of fighting Christian knight kind of behavior, ends up as the advisor to three separate kings. He becomes one of the most powerful people in England as a result of kind of following this chivalric mode all the way up. And as the years go by and the kind of the rawness and the kind of viciousness and violence of medieval times starts to cool down because things get a little bit more stable, we get this new idea of chivalry that moves into becoming a knight who is not only the best fighter and the most sporting and the fairest person, but also someone who has lots of other accomplishments. So here we have a couple of Christian knights who are here. We have the old idea of chivalry, that a knight will have his lady love, and we have the stories of Arthur and his most powerful and best warrior, Sir Lancelot, who is driven mad by the love of Guinevere, and kind of, but he can't possibly go with Guinevere because she's married to the king, who's also his leader, and it's this kind of drama of time. Here we've got someone who is a hunter, so he's good with animals, and he's also writing poetry. And so we note that the ability to speak more than one language and the ability to read and write re-emerges into the class of those who fight, and is no longer something that is simply for those who pray. It's no longer just a religious function. It's the mark of a good knight that he can, after winning an amazing battle, he can recite poetry and he can write love letters and he can act as a gentleman off the field. And it returns through this idea of knights being a kind of Christian holy thing to be, that being good at fighting is only one part of being an overall gentleman. We have this idea emerging of the court, and it's from these courts that later on we'll see emerges the Renaissance, but also the High Gothic kind of ideas of sophistication being something that's part of this worldly view. So this is from Froissart's Chronicles from 1410. Froissart's Chronicles are interesting because it's perhaps the most developed of this new type of book that comes out. So whereas books have for about 1,000 years existed purely to pass religion from one monk to the next and to celebrate religion, now we have books being written for royalty and for aristocratic families to tell the stories of their own heroism and to pass on their own kind of important stories and things. And so here we have quite a developed art style compared to what we saw in the early medieval times. People have started to look a bit more human shaped. The anatomy is not perfect, but we can see captured all of their different forms of clothing. There's loads of colour, we have all the motifs of the wallpaper and things up here. Although note, the faces are still all kind of the same. It's only later on that faces gain their individuality again, which was something that, you know, emerges from the classical world, a respect for the individual physiognomy. Here everyone's kind of a character type, but we have the king, we have his wife, we have all of the nobles, and they're all acting out these social roles. Interestingly, we are also seeing a return of, a development of formal art rule, the rules of art, the rules of composition and things. They're coming through, it's getting better in terms of our modern understanding of sophisticated art. I think it's really useful to look at this art before it's been coloured, because colour was so rare at the time that people weren't very practiced in using it. And so when we see these medieval books, they tend to be, they look quite flat, they look quite, you know, lacking in perspective and depth. But if we look at the Beauchamp pageant in 1485, we can see a fascinating glimpse into the true like ability of the artists of the late medieval period, of the kind of Gothic period. You can see the line art here is really, really detailed. It's not very good on this projection, I'm afraid, so you might want to have a look on your own screens. But the Beauchamp pageant is fascinating. It's from 1485, and it's because it was a book that was commissioned to be for this very rich family, but in the processes of it being done, the family were all killed. And so there was no one to pay the guy, and so the Beauchamp pageant just got left on a shelf. And so it's one of the very, very few examples we have of a medieval book that is just line art. It hasn't been coloured in. And we can see here that there's loads of detail on the armour. We've got some really nice sort of anatomical understanding of proportion in the human body and the horse body. And even more fascinatingly, we have perspective, which is not supposed to have been kind of developed. Well, it wasn't developed mathematically until the Renaissance, but wasn't really supposed to exist at this time. But by looking at the line art, what we can see is that they did understand perspective to an extent. It was just not done in a very kind of cohesive way. So down here, we have some people sat in the stands, and we can see that there's foreshortening going on, which suggests that this, you know, it gives it some depth, it gives it proportion. Both of these are in perspective with themselves and with a vanishing point that's down here. Meanwhile, up here, we have people gathered around the king, and they also are in perspective. We've got foreshortening working along these tables. We have the king who's smaller than this figure who's at the front, which is a shift from the idea of bigger people being more powerful. Instead, we've got a perspective with a kind of vanishing point above, a focal point above the king's head or on the king's crown. And then we've got perspective of these knights, where the one behind is smaller than the one in front. The problem is that these three different examples of perspective, even though they're exactly right next to each other in the same picture, are not the part of this. It's not the same perspective. These are three different examples of perspective that are all crushed into the same picture. And so we can kind of see that they've kind of working out what perspective is. They just haven't understood that you can only really have one perspective point if you want the image to make sense. Here is a good example of some warriors where we can see the level of anatomy that's there in the pencil drawings. So all of this is lost when they start colouring and inking it, because it just gets flattened by that, you know, by the application of colour. But we can see that the horses have, that's a person, we've got a knee, and we've got quite sophisticated feet. We've got a sense of the definition of the ankle and the calves, we've got a definition of the kneecap. Oh, there we've got some horse anatomy as well. The hands are very well done, which is surprising for a medieval work. And the amount of detail on this armour is really significant. We can see the rivets and the individual joints in it. Here we have a suggestion of individual character on the faces. So we've got an archbishop with some bishops around him, and we have a king. And on each of them, we can see that they've got a little bit of their own individual character, as if someone has drawn this who knows the faces of the people and thinks that it is important to show their faces as they really are, which is not a thought that occurred to people 100 or 200 years earlier. And so we have a king who's got a kind of eager look on his face as something is, there's a baptism going on here. The baby isn't very good, because babies never are at this time. But, you know, we've got a mustache on this bishop. This chap, who's a monk in the back holding the crozier, looks like he's probably had a little bit much to eat and drink. He's got a kind of hungover face. He's a bit corpulent compared to the others. But interestingly, they're sat in this castle, which is a totally stylized castle. We've got a suggestion in here of perspective, but it's in a tower that's not in perspective at all. Here we've got more examples of things that would individually make sense, but don't make sense because they're on the same page. So we have a very realistic looking boat, a very realistic looking piece of architecture, and we have a scene that's going on here. All three of them just stuck together in the same image, as if they didn't necessarily care that the image works as a single thing. Just lots of different focal points all bashed together. Same here with a dying chap. We can see that he's kind of inhabiting a cut-out room. We have these strange rooms in a lot of them where the walls have been cut away. They look like kind of doll's houses, and they've got a realistic scene, but inside a doll's house looking, or a stage looking house. This one's interesting because you can see the amount of detail that they've done in the cloaks. So you can see that they've got a really realistic sense of tactility, which is something that we see later on with oil paints, the ability to capture the feeling of a fabric through your artwork. So here it's cross-hatching and shading has allowed us to get a sense of like what these would feel like as well as how they look. And it's really sophisticated. That face on this chap here looks exactly like it could have been taken from a sort of Renaissance painting. It's, you know, he's got that really realistic look to him, a bit like a Raphael or something. So you can see there's a lot of sophistication in this line art, in the pencil work. But once it's coloured in, it gets flat again. It all looks medieval again. It's back to where we were at the start, with lots of strange looking proportions and unusual figures. And this is largely because you couldn't practice with colour, because the colour is so rare. Here we have Mother Mary and Joseph and the baby Jesus walking through Bethlehem. She's wearing a robe that admittedly has got a lot of volume in it. This pink volume, pink one doesn't have much volume here. But this robe is done in ultramarine, which is a royal blue associated with royalty and with also the royalty of heaven. So you can see it's up there in the sky. Ultramarine could only be created by grinding up lapis lazuli, which could only be found in Afghanistan. So this is from France. So you can imagine at a time when there was just constant war everywhere to get minerals from Afghanistan to France, they're going to be rare minerals. And so you're not going to be getting much practice at doing this kind of blue. The first time you put it on, you better well hope that it works. Pink is another one that you had to go to the Middle East or to India to get the things to make pink. And you see pink appearing more and more as we go through the late Gothic. And pink was associated with heaven. They had this idea that this otherworldly kind of glowing city of God would be largely constituted of kind of pink clouds, pink architecture. Surprising to us today, but as you'll see, it kind of fits this otherworldliness of it. It's kind of glowing pink. And so here we've got a saint who's wrapped in a pink and blue garment because he's royal, and he's wrapped in the sort of feeling of the other world. His cloak is otherworldly. It's like he's almost in heaven being a saint on this earth. And then gold leaf as well. So gold being crazy expensive, you would put it into your book to impress and to get across the holiness of these people. So, you know, you put it on the halos, because as you're going through the book, you see actual gold, this hugely rare thing, and in the flickering candlelight, it comes alive. It has all this liquid light flickering out of it, and it really just drives home the point, like, firstly, this is an impressive book. The things that it say here, this big letter that's got gold on it, that's important. And also, like, these people are important and they're holy, because we're willing to use gold to indicate that. So, we shall continue on to our final of these three groups. This is those who work. Now, as I mentioned before, you don't necessarily see much of the 90% of people who existed in Europe during this time. Those who work are largely written off as being sort of serfs and peasants. Their duty was to work and to slave until they dropped dead, or to go off to fight in horrific battles against knights who they couldn't possibly damage because they had like sharpened tools and the knights were dressed in full plate armor. So it wasn't a great time if you were a medieval peasant, and most people were. When you see them depicted, they tend to be like this, where we've got these peasants out in the field doing jobs. And here they're largely being used as like part of the landscape intended to illustrate what's actually here, this castle. So this drawing of a castle, it includes some peasants just because it's kind of, you know, it's there for a bit of set up the atmosphere a little bit. Or else they're doing kind of peasanty things like playing music here and dancing with a dog and holding hands. They all have this very squat demeanor, which is part of that idea that smaller means less important, but also would be a real indication of the actual biology of medieval serfs, who would have a horrible diet of just, you know, grains and porridge and very, very little else. And so they would be stunted and they would be kind of crooked because of all of the various different diseases that they would have. And their life would be largely a life like these people down here, miserable, if you can see his face, suffering, pain, constant threat of death. There was more chance that a child would die before it was born than it would live. I think 3 of 4 died before they reached adulthood. The average age was 25. For context, if you have ever had antibiotics, you would have died at this time. So I certainly would have died. I think most of us in the modern world would have, in the context of this. And this is before you even factor in that, you know, the Black Death came along and just wiped out 1 in 5 people. Whole towns would disappear in these plagues. And so, yeah, it was a vicious time full of lots of pain and suffering. And so when we look at the kinds of artwork and kind of motifs that capture the imagination of this time. They have a real fatalism about them. So this is one in particular that's really popular. This is the Wheel of Fortune. Now, the Wheel of Fortune was first sort of described by Boethius in his book, The Consolation of Philosophy. Interestingly, Boethius was a pagan writer back in Rome, but because his book was copied and copied and copied by generations of monks, it was felt that it was okay for them to change things if they didn't quite fit. So when he starts talking about the importance of the gods, you could cross out the S. When he starts talking about Mars or Venus, you could cut out Mars and you could say Saint Michael, because, you know, he's an angel who has a sword. Or Venus, cross that one out and call it, you know, Mother Mary. And so his book gets changed and changed and changed. But this core image of the Wheel of Fortune retains its kind of power, and it gets talked about and sort of depicted all the way through the medieval times. So the Wheel of Fortune is this idea that no matter who you are personally, your just rewards in this world are entirely based upon chance and upon the Wheel of Fortune. So here we have some knights moving up the Wheel of Fortune and becoming a bishop. Then right at the top of the Wheel of Fortune is the king, but this king is being cast down. And then down here we have people cast out, dying, sort of suffering as the wheel turns around. And the idea is that you shouldn't be happy as you ascend, because it's the same wheel that pulls you up. It will cast you down and crush you and kill you. But at the same time, you shouldn't be sad when you're cast down into the abyss, because the very same wheel the next day might lift you up into the heavens. And it's entirely, you know, you can see here the Wheel of Fortune is blind. It's a blind angel who just operates, and there's a kind of total uncontrollable, unpredictable sense of this. It's totally fatalistic. It's the worldview suggests that, you know, on this world everything is chaos and fortune. What we should look to is the next world. Speaking of which, there is a huge focus on violence, death, and hell. So here is hell with lots of naked bodies being thrust down. There's a giant skeleton over the top of it, sort of looking over it, looming. The figure of death, of decay. This is what happens to all human bodies, is they decay away. And down here we have these naked bodies in suffering and pain. You know, the human body is used as an image of the material suffering of the world. So here is a snake creature that's tearing and rending apart this guy, pulling him to bits. He's either going into or out of his mouth, both of which look like they would be quite unpleasant. We have demons, we have a screaming face that's been ripped off someone, black, terrifying sort of dragon, skull-like creatures grinning, and have, you know, this one's got human teeth and terrifying eyes. And the reason that all of this stuff really captures the imagination, part of it is, you know, the old classic tale of, like, the church needed to control people because it was a time where order was very kind of fragile, and so they would use terrifying images to make sure that people did what they were told. But also there is the fact that life was suffering and pain for these people. There was not very much that they could do to change that. And what these images suggest is that there is redemption through physical pain. That if you suffer physically on this earth, that will allow your soul to be purified so that when you die, you'll go to heaven. So the physicalness of suffering could be a path to redemption. So you won't go to hell, because the reason people go to hell is because they've had too much pleasure in this life. So if you get your pain over in this life, you'll go off to heaven. It was the same theory behind why they would burn heretics, because they thought that it was a kind thing to do, because if they burn them in this life, they won't have to burn in the next life, which, you know, as far as the perverse ways of thinking goes, is up there. But as well as all the physical pain and suffering, there's also a lot of physical humour. This is something that's not particularly appreciated, but there's a lot of kind of, by a lot of people, when you think of the medieval times, you don't think of fun and games. But there was a lot of like fart jokes, a lot of bodily humour that speaks of the dirt and kind of lack of sophistication of this time. So here we've got a chap who's playing a flute from both ends. Here we've got a sculpture in a cathedral of a guy with his bum out. I don't know whether that is a depiction of Conrad von Hochstaden, or just Conrad von Hochstaden is unlucky enough to have had his name next to a guy getting his bum out. But either way, that's up there in stone in the midst of a cathedral. Here is the infamous woman picking penises from the penis tree to take home with her. And here is a monk getting his own back on a nun playing a trumpet out of his bum. They had a very sort of gritty sense of humour, a kind of very, you know, bodily based. If we look at the work of Hieronymus Bosch, in particular the Garden of Earthly Delights, his most famous one, we can see fascinatingly all of these elements of medieval mindset captured but using techniques which are more sophisticated than we normally see in medieval art. So Bosch is actually quite late on. Bosch is around the time of the early Renaissance. So stuff is happening in down in Southern Europe, which is a lot more sophisticated, but he takes that sophistication of art and uses it to depict the medieval mindset. So we see a much more highly developed artistic form, but of the mindset of the medieval times. So in the Garden of Earthly Delights, we see the pink of heaven. So up in the top here, we have these pink and blue, very, very peculiar, strange images of heaven. But this is the idea that we can't conceive of the world beyond. We can't conceive of the transcendental world. It won't be like our world. And so here we have fantasy, dreamlike, kind of bubblegum-looking creatures and heavenly things that are all up in the top half of this. Down in the middle, we have the powerful people, those who fight, who we can see are all traveling around in a merry-go-round, all of them naked. The reason there's so many naked people and animals is because it's suggesting that human beings, if left to their own devices in the world, will become as sinful as animals. They will have no holy soul. And so here, those who fight in the aristocracy are traveling in an endless wheel of power, just trying to focus on things of this world and ignoring the things above. And beneath them is everyone else, all kind of involved in lascivious sort of eating, sex. We've got this strange boat that people are feeling each other up on. There's a duck with people riding on it, lots of birds. Birds again being a symbol of the poor, as well as being an indication of kind of bestial nature-like beasts. People are kissing, eating things, being eaten themselves. Someone's happy here because she's got a gigantic strawberry she's about to eat. And then here, in the Garden of Eden, we have Jesus dressed all in pink, and we have our ancestors, Adam and Eve, who are being shown the way by Jesus, but are sort of being drawn into this deadly pit of hell. And then over on this side, which is after death, we have our image of hell. And so hell is down here among the bodily sins, is the bodily sins being done the other way. So whereas you've eaten too much, now you get eaten. You've had too much sex, now you're kind of stuck in a world of hellish sexual punishments. Someone's getting eaten by a bird who's got a cauldron for a hat. Up here is the kind of psychological world of punishment and torture, where we've got dreamlike scenes of people living inside each other's bodies and kind of a chaotic dreamscape where they can't escape. And up here is a kind of social image of hell and destruction, which looks suspiciously kind of like the Blitz, like a destroyed city. It's got wrecked buildings, fire. We can see knights on armor with black banners, which is never a good thing. We've got lights shining through smoke and mist and fog. If we take just that top right-hand corner, we can see this is a modern image of hell. It's like a Second World War battlefield. You know, it's real-life hell on Earth, which was a definite threat then, is a definite threat now. And it's brought into this psychological, spiritual space as an indication that what we want is to be up here with these pink bubblegum things, enjoying a kind of endless party in paradise. But what we've ended up with is hell because of sin. If we look at the art of this time, we can see that it's simultaneously kind of has the order that's been brought back from the classical. So here in the composition of this piece, The Last Judgment by Stephen Lochner, we have, you know, composition of, we've got a triangle for the Holy Trinity right in the middle, but then we have all of this kind of chaos of human flesh, writhing masses and things going on. And it's the classical sense of order meeting that terrifying pagan sense of life being crawling over itself, full of vitality, but also full of sort of terrifying nature in its most raw form. And the legacy of these two comes and creates the Gothic. In terms of this, we also have the constant threat of death, and the Danse Macabre is a perfect kind of summation of this image of mortality that's enjoyed by the people of the medieval times. So the Dance of Death, they're everywhere when you start looking for them. I went to a church Newark. It's not a very interesting town, but they had this church that looked really old, so I thought, I'll go in there for half an hour while I'm waiting for something. And in there they had a Dance of Death, and it was just this not looking as good as these, a very medieval image. And you know, there's a guy there who was clearly thought he was all the rage. He had these big, long shoes on and a big fancy hat, and he was wearing furs, and he had this look on his face like, yeah, I'm the coolest guy that's ever lived. And on his arm is a skeleton, ready to drag him down into the grave. And so there's a kind of democratic sense to the Danse Macabre. It was, people really loved it, I think, because it's such a hierarchical society. There's so much power in the hands of the warrior class and of the church, that for average people to be reminded that all these people die is kind of a celebration for them. So here we've got a detail from one Danse Macabre where we have lots of different women of different stations in life. So we have kind of women who look like housewives, women who look like fishwives, who look like nurses, and then we've got a queen in the back, and a second queen here. In medieval art, the queens tend to be, or kings tend to be, of foreign countries, because it would be traitorous to depict your own. These are kind of fashionable headbands, suggesting that these ladies are kind of fashionable women, middle-class women, and all of them are dancing a ring around the rosy, around the grave, and holding hands with death. That dance of going round in a circle was a popular dance at the time of the Black Death, and it was thought to be particularly sinful because people held each other's hands, whereas here they're holding hands with skeletons, meaning death. Here we've got a more kind of sophisticated one from a bit later on, where we have Death doing a little jig, dancing about, and next to him is a cardinal who's sort of grasping for his heart whilst his hand is being taken by Death. And here we've got a very fancy-looking woman, perhaps a kind of lady of high standing, whose arm is being taken by the dancing Death as well. Hans Holbein does a very famous series called The Dance of Death in 1525. In it, he goes through each of the stations of life and demonstrates how all of them are mortal and all of them are prepared to die. So here we have a knight dressed in plate armor. He's got his big codpiece. He's got his giant feathered hat. He's the man around town. He's, you know, an important guy. And you wouldn't want to face him on the battlefield because he's in this impenetrable armor. And yet, who's this behind him? Well, it's a knight who stabbed him through the guts with a giant lance. And who is that knight? It's Death. And Death has, you know, snuck upon him and taken him out. And there's his time has run out in the form of an hourglass on the ground. Here we have a fancy lady who's in her posh bed. We know she's rich because she's got all of these covers. She's got fancy kind of patterns all over the walls, tapestries. She got a little lap dog down here, which, you know, was as popular then with rich women as it is today. And she's woken up because she's heard some beautiful music, but who's playing the fiddle? It's Death. And who is this beside her? It's another dead skeleton with sort of beautiful long flowing hair, suggesting this was once a rich damsel like you, but now she too is dead, as you shortly shall be. Some of them are a bit more kindly, so here's a nice old man being led by a very friendly Death into the grave. He's sort of carrying him along, leading him in. Here is the Kaiser, the King of Kings, the King of all of the different... There were lots of like sub-kings in Germany, and they all answered to the Emperor, the Kaiser. And so he's possibly one of the most powerful people in the world. And here he's depicted making important decisions with all of his advisors. And down here we have the earth, we have his own time that's about to run out. We have scepters, we have swords, and here's a chap on his knees begging and pleading to the Kaiser. He's an important guy, but who's this that he hasn't quite seen stood up on his throne? It's Death, and the Death's about to snap his neck and steal his crown. Even religious figures die, as Hans Holbein reminds us. So here is one of the most important people out of those who pray, who is a bishop, and he's walking out into the town. A bell is being rung so that people know to come out. Incense is smoking. He feels very magical. People are supposed to come out and make sure, you know, ask for blessings and things. But who's ringing the bell and carrying the incense? Well, it's a skeleton dressed up as a priest, and we know where he's leading him, to the grave. Here we have a pregnant couple and Death banging the drum, which suggests that, like many couples, this will not end well for them. And then here is one that I think is particularly tasteless, but is, where we've got some poor people around a fire, and their little child is being stolen away by Death. So if we looked at it from just these three figures' perspective, this is an incredibly tragic scene. But Holbein has given this skeleton the cheekiest face of any skeleton I've ever seen. He's really having a good time stealing this child away as the parents scream and moan. Now, a lot of this seems, you know, unremittingly grim to us, and you kind of wonder, why would people who are surrounded by Death find this funny? Possibly because they were, you know, there's a sense of dark humor to it. But also we have to remember that they believe that Death was the final release from this body. This body is constant torment in order to purify our soul. So when we die, we get to go off to heaven. And so all of these people dying it's kind of, it shows us that we're all human and it levels us all. Death is the great leveler. But also it's sort of a happy ending if you are of this mindset where you constantly are looking to the other world and not to this one. Some of the more unusual kind of examples of the body being used in a kind of vicious way can be found in what we call the Crucifixus Dolorus, or also known as the Plague Crosses. These are particularly grim depictions of Jesus on the cross. When we have Jesuses on crosses outside or inside of churches today, they tend to be quite, you know, photo-friendly. Jesus looks a little bit sad. He doesn't look like he's in agony. And sometimes he's even wearing clothes as he's up on the cross. I've seen him dressed as a king on the cross, which is, you know, a nice image. Whereas here, during the times of the plague, there was a real fad for making Jesus look as tortured and brutalized as possible. Interestingly, we get an increased appreciation of anatomy in the same way that, weirdly, the kind of institutionalized paedophilia of Athens led to really realistic anatomy. Here we've got a kind of institutionalized, or at least social, obsession with death and rotten decay, leading to an appreciation for anatomy where we can see Jesus's kind of bones through the flesh. He's got these kind of painful looking joints and blood and suppurations, lots of kind of grotesque. He looks haunted and hollow. He looks like a real corpse. This one is particularly gross, I think, because the flash of it makes it look a little bit like a picture of an actual dead body. And he's got covered in wounds, blood everywhere. It's a really kind of gross, what to us today look quite a disrespectful image of Jesus. But for them, at a time where, you know, the Black Death meant that suddenly a whole town could be wiped out overnight. Your family could just die in front of your eyes. Your neck would swell up into huge black pustules and explode. You know, people were bleeding from every orifice. It was a grotesque and monstrous time to be alive. And they unusually took some kind of sense of, I don't know, satisfaction or hope, I suppose, in seeing Jesus this brutalized, because it promises that if Jesus could go through all this and then rise again, we too will find heaven through our own suffering. Which brings us to our kind of final image of the lecture, which is the body of dead Christ in the tomb by Hans Holbein the Younger from 1521. So this is a fascinating image because it's a super hyper realistic looking Jesus, essentially in a coffin. So he's in the tomb, but here it looks like a coffin. We can see that all that anatomy that has been the focus of the Renaissance has now been learned. Those lessons of the Renaissance have seeped up into Northern Europe. And here we have someone who's got all that Renaissance talent applying it to what's still a Gothic mindset, which is to look at Jesus as a dead body. So we can see that his muscles are in a state of rigor mortis. They've gone all taut. We can see the sort of knobbly knees and that kind of hypertense tendons sort of stretching out. We can see the bruising of the kind of suppurating wounds on his hands and his feet. His hands are all creased up and gone, they've turned black. His face has got these glassy eyes staring out like a corpse of nothing. His hair is all greasy, like he's suffered for, you know, weeks and not washed it. It's just an image of a dead body, a kind of very visually realistic dead body. And his hands and his hair are kind of leaning over the side as if they're coming out of the picture at us. It's very, you know, three-dimensional. It puts us there looking at the dead Christ. Christ being essentially God, who's come to earth to save humanity. And humanity has turned around and killed him, because that's what we're like on this world. And it's a shocking image. But it was shocking for the time. But that was part of it, was that this was to get across that this is what, you know, the material world is. And what we should be aiming for is the moment after he returns. So, yeah, the Gothic period often goes underappreciated in art history. We've got an image here of kind of classic Gothic, you know, people sat around in the Last Supper eating things. There's the devil sat on the back sort of shoulder of Judas in the Last Supper. Lots of gold, lots of angels and things. It's a time of not particularly sophisticated artistic talent, but hopefully we've seen that, you know, that talent kind of emerged out of what's essentially a post-apocalyptic society. That at the end of Rome, we have an apocalypse, all of civilization is lost. And in this sort of shadow of civilization, the post-apocalyptic society finds a language of art to explain its own suffering to itself and to turn that suffering and chaos into something which is redemptive, which gives power to its own kind of religion and to its own way of seeing the world. Yeah, it's a time of very striking contrasts. And it's from this that we start to gain an appreciation for anatomy and perspective that, as we'll see next week, leads into the Renaissance, which is a time that's slightly less grim. So we shall call it a day there.